You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. Creativity Comes from the Subconscious by Edwin A. Locke.
Creativity comes from the subconscious, or does it? So let's define creativity to start with. Ayn Rand's definition was basically the power to bring into existence an arrangement or combination or integration of natural elements that had not existed before, to serve human purposes. So human creations, human creations satisfy or help create wants and needs. So here are some examples that you're all familiar with. Safety, the Otis elevator, which, by the way, was in a time travel movie some years ago, if you ever saw that. Otis was the boyfriend of the star. Kevlar vest, protection against injury. Calculation, computers. Comfort. Now, you may not know, the maidenform bra was only invented in the late 1800s. So you might wonder, what the heck happened before that? Well, from what little reading I know, they wrapped women in sheets to make them look like men. That was one way to deal with it. The other was steel corsets, which were basically described as torture chambers. So this was a fantastic invention for women. And maidenform was the first one. Now, of course, there's probably 100 companies that make bras. Clothing for multiple uses, like blue jeans. Convenience, like electric lights, flush toilets, the supermarket, the automobile, the subway, Domino's Pizza, Amazon, Google, and cell phones. Pleasure through making art more available, the phonograph, the radio, the CD, DVDs, movies, TVs, play, concerts, opera, ballet, often streamlined. And of course, Ayn Rand made a tremendous contribution to what the real role of art in life is. If you read a lot of the stuff in like the New York Times, they mock you for wanting fun programs or Agatha Christie, because it's just escapism. It's just escapism. But Ayn Rand showed it was fuel for a living. So a very important identification. Efficiency and speed, the printing press, the telephone, telegraph, undersea cables, the microchip. Cost reduction, the assembly line. Yeah, I don't know how many of you know the McCormick Reaper helped win the Civil War because it freed northern farmers from reaping wheat because the reaper could do 100 times as much as a person and freed them for fighting against slavery. Cyrus McCormick was a great hero in his own right. Container ships, sewing machines, robots, energy, oil drilling, natural gas, coal, solar cells, battery-powered windmills. By the way, oil is still king and will be for a long time. Health, the pacemaker, the MRI, x-rays, blood tests, surgical techniques, drugs, vitamin, nutrition, weapons, guns, tanks, bombers. And by the way, the atomic bomb, which is criticized constantly by the left, was a tremendous achievement. You may not know, the Nazis were trying to build one too. Now they screwed up, partly thanks to Hitler. They screwed up and couldn't do it. They were shocked when we did it. But it was, if they had gotten the atomic bomb first, could have been a total disaster for us and for all of Europe. So it was a tremendously important discovery. The most radically visionary creators invented things no one wanted or asked for because the invention didn't exist or could not exist. They believed people would want it if they did exist. You know, I don't know if you know, the first Xerox machine was projected. The worldwide use of Xerox copies would be $250,000, 250,000 copies. That was the market. That's it. The PC, the cell phone, the airplane. Now, a lot of the preliminary work in computers was done by hackers, kind of hippie hackers. And mainly for fun, they got quite upset when capitalists started to make money from computers. And without the capitalist, they would still be domain of hippies. Some innovations simply improved what already was there, such as Walmart discount retailing, which Sam Walton didn't invent, but he certainly made it, he perfected it better than anyone else. 19th century began a period of massive invention, continuing at an accelerating pace to this day, and especially in capitalist countries. So my theme today is going to be the primary role of the conscious mind in creativity. And I'll show as we progress the role of the subconscious mind, but there's I'm going to show that the conscious mind does the main work here. And it's been misleading because if you read creativity books, a lot of them get into brainstorming. Well, I'm not against brainstorming, perfectly fine. But brainstorming is pulling things out from your subconscious you already know. Or the quickie insight puzzles, like connecting the dots, you know, thinking outside the square. Well, that's fine, but where's that going to take you after that? So I want to talk about creations that are a little bit broader in scope than those examples. So here's a quote from Mark Zuckerberg, founder of Facebook. Ideas typically do not come to you. They happen because you've been thinking about something and talking to a lot of people about it for a long time, end of quote. So the subconscious cannot replace that, as we'll see. Now, except for Ayn Rand being mentioned briefly, I'm going to stay away from the field of art in this talk, because any such focus would have to deal with the problem of objective criteria for artworks. And objectivists totally disagree with modern standards. To give you one example, Marianne Seres has pointed out, you can't paint an abstraction. You cannot paint an abstraction. You can only make a concrete that conveys an abstraction. Try to do abstraction directly, it's just smears on canvas. So to get into that is a whole nother lecture or three. So let's talk about preconditions, enablers, facilitators for creativity before we're getting into the processes involved. First of all, political and economic freedom, including protection of property rights and including patents. I don't know if you know much about Mozart. I feel sorry for Mozart. One performance and his money was gone. They didn't have patent protection for music. So he made 643 things, good for him. But as soon as he did one, no more money. So it's a tremendous incentive to have patents, of course. At the organizational level, of course, the issue is autonomy, reasonable autonomy, financial support from the company, and leadership support. How about the culture? Respect for invention and dedication to reason versus faith and mysticism. You're not going to see, this is terrible for me to say, but I don't think Islam is a very good place to have great creative inventions because they're totally based on faith. And they disown the concept of natural law. If I said this at Berkeley, I'm sure they would riot and beat me up. So some respect for individualism. Many countries have the concept, the tall poppy has its head cut off, which is famous for Australia, but it's famous everywhere. Don't rise above the crowd because of envy. Why do Americans seem to avoid this? Because we have a concept of individualism and achievement. It's very interesting to me, I'm not a historian, but why are the big breakthroughs like Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and the like made by Americans, not by Europeans? Well, Europeans really, they're not socialist, but they really don't like capitalism. They need the money, at least give them credit for that, but they don't like capitalists rising above. They don't like them being too powerful. And they resent successful companies, especially in Europe, because the competition is unfair. Unfair means too good for the other people to match. I have this vision of the European mentality in soccer. The ideal soccer score is 1-0 because it's focused on defense. I'd much rather see 15-10, be a lot more exciting, but they want 1-0 is much better for them. All right, so let's turn to my core ideas. Conscious individual traits and actions. I tried to get it down to 3 because it would be better, but I couldn't do it. But I started with about 15. I got it down to 7. It's the best I can do. So it's at the borderline of overload, but I think you can deal with it. So what's the starting point for creative activity? Purpose. Constant desire or goal to create or innovate, which may be broad or narrow, maybe improving an existing product or invent a new one or a new service. Of course, there are degrees. Now, the constant desire to create involves what I call achievement motivation. Achievement motivation involves ambition and meeting some standard of excellence or standard of success. The object or the product has to work. And in addition, if you want to make money, it has to be something that you can market successfully. So you have standards you have to meet if you want to be successful. And that takes a lot of conscious thought. In an organization, you can have assigned goals for creativity. Steve Jobs, as you know, visited a place called Xerox PARC, which did some innovative work at the time he started. Xerox PARC had, Xerox never used Xerox PARC, but it was, had a lot of great things they came up with. Xerox PARC had a $400 mouse. It was complex, unreliable, and useless. But the mouse involved a lot of great things, including freedom of implementation and saving time and trouble. So he assigned a group to make him a mouse for between $10 and $35. He says, that's what I want. You've got to make that. And they did. $400 one is, in addition to being too expensive, couldn't even be used. A company can require inventions. 3M company, you know, the ones who did Scotch tape and Post-it notes, they used to have a goal, I don't know if they still have that, 50% of products have to be new every 5 years. So it's a demand for innovative products. Now, I don't know if they still have that, but I looked up, they make 55,000 products. And they make $30 billion a year in income and tens of thousands of jobs. And they not only encourage and demand it, they give you time off to follow, some time off to follow your own ideas for inventions such as Post-it notes, which wasn't accepted at first. So you need a goal to start with. Passion, especially entrepreneurs, passion is good for everybody in their career, but entrepreneurs especially have to have selfish, personal interest, love of the process, and the content of the work or creation, independent of others' expectations. So I label this intrinsic motivation. The terms in psychology are a bit confused. By intrinsic motivation, I mean love of the product activities, deep personal involvement and curiosity about the activity that you're involved in, and you might work as some high-tech people, all night or even 2 days, long hours, over and above the desire for money or fame. Now, you know, Reardon in Atlas Shrugged wanted money, and Ayn Rand was defending the desire for money, but Reardon loved steel, and he loved innovation in steel, as shown by the invention of Reardon metal. So Howard Roark and the founder said, look, you want to do architecture, you must love the doing, the process. Not necessarily every last detail, you can delegate some, but you have to love what's involved in creating the product. So obviously you can see that if you combine achievement motivation with intrinsic motivation, loving the doing, loving doing well. It's a tremendously potent force for action. And they're mutually reinforcing, but they're not the same. All right. Active conceptual thought. So it's stimulating yourself by initiating a thinking process. Now, you've all heard, how many have heard of the concept of an open mind? Not quite right. Not quite right. Now think of what that would mean if you took it too literally. Take off, chop off your head and leave it empty, and people pour stuff in. That's the open mind, and then they close it off. Ha, you got a full mind now. This is not good. Dumping slop, undigested thoughts by themselves are not going to help you. It's way too passive. So Ayn Rand's substitute was what? An active mind. Much better concept, an active mind. So you're taking in stuff, but you're processing it through conscious volitional activity. Question asking, problem finding, volitional question asking, envisioning, trying to see future potential for something, projecting, connecting, hypothesizing, questioning, learning, integrating. These are all aspects of the active mind. Way too many students today have empty minds because they don't process. So they're just filled with stuff, often which contradicts the other stuff the other professors tell them, and they come out with a total hash. Now, usually you need some other people to work with because most people are not omniscient and are not running a one-person show. They don't have enough knowledge or time. So they need to expose themselves and seek out other active minds to get intellectual stimulation. So let's talk about diversity. Let's talk about, what do you think, racial and sexual diversity? No, no, no. No, no, no. It's not the way we come at things. It's a very, very bad collectivist notion. What do you want? One of the books on the list, What You Want, said cognitive diversity, diversity of thought, diversity of ideas. And it's individualistic, not collectivistic. And ideas are not from your genes or your skin color or your gender. Ideas are acquired after birth, not born with them. So you can't assume everyone from a certain race is going to have these ideas, another group, those ideas, another group, those ideas. It's ridiculous. So it's not showing respect for the fact that groups are made of individuals. The group is an abstraction. It's not an entity. It's an abstraction. The abstraction is consisted of concretes, which are individual people with individual minds. So you need to make sure you find colleagues with something to add. So you need active colleague finding. Need to find people with needed ability, interest, skills, especially ones that complement one another. This would include knowledge of how to bring a product to fruition. And many of the big companies, you know, were famous for their duos. So Brendan Page at Google, Nois, Moore, and Grove at HP, Jobs and Wozniak at Apple, and others. So you need to know each of you can complement one another and stimulate one another, and yet you're on the same wavelength. And you have to know who's good at what. So you do need to let your thoughts come freely because you need stimulation and not inhibition every time you come up with a new idea. And you need it from as many directions as you can tolerate. But how freely? Ultimately, at some point, you have to sort the ideas out. this isn't usually talked about in creativity. You must know or learn what needs not to follow. You can't create successfully without active selective focus. And there's almost an unlimited number of ways to go wrong, not as many ways to go right. Here's what Steve Jobs said. Innovation means saying no to 1,000 things. Deciding what not to do is usually not recognized, but it's very critical. Henry Ford rejected steam-powered cars. He rejected luxury cars because they were too expensive. And he and his engineers would create dozens of parts, such as carburetors. And then he would pick out of all the carburetors, there was one experiment, they put 12 of them on a table, and he came and looked at them all, and he said, that one, it was the right one. Jobs rejected early jobs, rejected early computers, because they were made for wonks. Slow, ugly, clumsy, confusing, and inefficient. And he chose to go in a new direction so that you would get rid of these problems. Another thing creators have to do is beware of feature creep. Now, you're probably too old to remember this, but the old days of the VCR was the first way on your TV of copying shows. Well, it had about 100 buttons. I couldn't figure it out. My wife couldn't figure it out. The only person in the household who could figure it out is my 9-year-old daughter. She was able to do it. We couldn't do it. Well, now it's extremely easy. You push 2 buttons and you're recording a show. So why were these 100 buttons here? Well, they were brilliant engineers who said, I have an idea of what we need. But they didn't think of, well, what do people actually want and what can they understand? So if you have too many bells and whistles, it can be a very big problem. I'm going to come back to this more than once. Simplicity is often underrated in technology. My personal, and I'm not very high tech, and at my age I get confused more easily, but my favorite website by a huge margin is Amazon. It's so elegant and simple and easy to follow. Now let me contrast this. I was on a trip to San Francisco at a Hilton hotel, and I had a lot of things I didn't like about the hotel, so I wanted to give them feedback, and I wanted to find out how to send it. So I went online to Hilton Hotels, trying to find how to contact this hotel. They had 7 sites. Then I tried clicking on each of them. It took me about 45 minutes to get the phone number for that hotel. I'm not kidding you. I was totally bollocksed. Finally found for that hotel, and I called and I said, you have a real problem with your website. Okay, what can I do for you, sir? They wouldn't care. I didn't care. So simplicity is tremendous, and there's a philosophical principle behind this. You know what that is? Ayn Rand's crow principle, crow epistemology, that you can't hold in conscious mind more than about 7 things at the same time. If you do, you've got to push them out, send them to the subconscious, or combine them, or delegate them, but you can't hold everything in mind. So when they try to make stuff too complicated, people can't follow it. This has some implications, by the way, for technological progress. Apple products themselves are often made with simplicity in mind, deliberately. Okay. Active research and experimentation. Now here, the key is induction. Basically, it means trying stuff. Experiment, trial and error, collecting data, getting feedback. In the book by Isaacson, which is a very interesting summary of the whole technology from back in, 1700 or something to the present, talks about the invention of the transistor, which was a very big step in the process of developing advanced technology. Now, they didn't know how to make a transistor. They knew what they wanted to do to combine certain elements together. They did scores of experiments over and over and over. Nothing worked, nothing worked, nothing worked. Finally, something worked. Then they had to invent a theory to explain what they found. Now, this is kind of interesting because in my field, you're supposed to invent the theory ahead of time. It's caused tremendous problems. I've been one of the few rebels in my field for inductive research, but it's terrible. You have to invent a theory, which are often faked after the fact. Then you've got to test it. And then you've got to say, make sure it comes out. You sometimes fudge the data, and you fudge the hypotheses. And then you do the fudge the statistics. And then you say, OK, it's proven, end of theory building. One study. It's a terrible disaster. So theory building is a process, not something you do rationalistically. If you already have a really good theory that's really well developed, like Einstein, you can then make predictions for new findings. But Einstein's theory was 1925, so there's a lot of data now. Now you can make predictions from it. So you need to get objective feedback. You need to talk to people. You need to make prototypes for customer trials. You may ask potential customers questions. What do you think of this product? They say, this stinks. Here's why. Back to the drawing board. Try it again. Discover what problems people have when trying to use something you invented. One of my pet peeves over than bad websites, one of the things I really hate, is phone systems where you can't talk to a person. Now, the problem is, this is robots. The phone systems are really stupid. Half the time, the choices are not anything you want. So what are you supposed to do? So I'll try to push the wrong button to see if I can get a person. Then they send you to another menu. So then I try, go back to start over, pick another thing I don't want, send you to another menu. And you pray, I wish there's, if I pushed O, a person would answer, please, please, a person. So these, you know, Isaacson has a very low opinion of robots doing thinking. Now, I'm not a tech expert, but he says they really don't do a very good job. Maybe they will, but they're really best at doing mechanical, repetitive work. So they tell you they love your business and want to save you time, but actually they waste time and simply annoy people. So get feedback from customers. You can't give feedback on the phone system because there's no people there. And if you do complain, say, what can I help you with? So you have to try stuff, expect the unexpected. Don't try to predict everything. You have to see what works. Okay, integrating the conscious and the subconscious. Now, said I promised you I would talk about the subconscious, so now I'm going to do it. There are two aspects to this. One is what I call, I use the term pulsing, and I'll explain why I'm using that. It's a simple concept. Personal pulsing. You need to think, and then you need time alone, separate from others. Many creators are self-educated because they're very brilliant. They deliberate, think, study, learn, experiment, connect, envision, and this gets filed in the subconscious. Then they deliberately, not just necessarily because they're sleepy, deliberately take time away. Their favorite activity is usually walking, sometimes jogging, sometimes showering, sometimes sleeping. I wouldn't depend too much on discoveries after dreams. You read great stories in this about, but I wouldn't count on that. It might happen, it might not happen. But all this helps because you're programming the subconscious and then you're giving it a rest. Now, what's the subconscious doing during this time out. It's not clear what it is, but it's probably some form of consolidation. I think this was Ayn Rand's view, but it's hard to prove it because it's hard to get into the subconscious since you're not conscious of it. But when you finish and go back to it, you often get a fresh perspective on things. I was writing my free will book over a period of years. I would come in and out and in and out. Every single time I'd start back at the beginning in chapter one and then move ahead to, and then add a chapter or part of a chapter. I'd always get a new insight or a new perspective. See things that didn't feel right before, now you know why. See things that were non sequiturs. Identifies problems, identify nagging doubts that you have to pursue more. And again, when your time off, this will be stored again, and you can repeat the process, and there's no limit to the number of pulses you can do or the time span. It can be minutes, hours, days, months, and it can be years. Now, the whole time, there's a consciously chosen purpose. Conscious mind, you've given orders. This is the beginning, the purpose. But you may change directions as a result of the new insights after pulsing. You also need social pulsing. So with others, who are your colleagues, talk, argue, discuss, envision, problem solve, have fights, then all take time alone, then come back together, repeat, meet, argue, and do it again. And keep going until you feel the evidence indicates you're on the right track. So it's the same principle, but you're freeing yourself from others, and the others are doing the same themselves. So this is really allowing your subconscious to consolidate, feed you back when you come back to it, and you can keep going as long as you want. Don't have any rules about how many times you should do it. Persistence in thought and action. You have to spend a lot of time when you're creating something new. Gates used to work up to 36 hours and sleep under his desk. Not now, but when he started and was single. It's not good to be married when you're doing that. You also have to expect to fail. Some, and probably most of the time, one company looked at all of their patents that their engineers had filed, 99% were not useful. Edison had 1,000 patents, approximately. Most were useless. So you have to treat failure as a necessary dead end, a learning experience of, as Edison said, well, I failed, but it was good because I learned stuff that doesn't work, until he finally found a filament for the light bulb that did work. So failures simply are a signal to keep moving. It's also found from studies that geniuses have way more failures than others. Way more failures. Why? Because they try more stuff. They have active minds. Most of them don't work, but they have so many ideas, they keep at it. Some of them work. So what's the creator's view of obstacles? Here's a quote in one of the books on my list from Vera Rubin, who I believe was a Harvard astronomer at a time, I don't know what year this was, but it was prejudice against female astronomers. She said, "I never took it seriously." Now, does that quote remind you of anyone? Who? Dagny. What was the statement Dagny replied to? No, no, that's a different one. That's about pain. This is about her career. She was told, I don't know what age, a young age, sorry, but women don't run railroads. I'm very sorry, but they don't do that. What did she say? To hell with that, she said, and never thought about it again. I don't know if Ayn Rand got flack for being a woman philosopher. There are some, but there aren't that many, and certainly not many famous ones. Let me talk about the Southwest Airline hero, Tammy Jo Schultz. Do you all know that story? Southwest Airlines had an engine explode in mid-flight. She was the pilot, one of the two pilots. I think she was the head pilot. Now, Tammy Jo Schultz wanted to be, from an early age, a fighter pilot. And she went to the Air Force and they said, sorry, women aren't fighter pilots. Go away, little lady. No, we don't do that. Go somewhere else. So she wouldn't give up. So she went to the Navy. And after many arguments, the Navy hired her. She became a fighter pilot for 10 years. Now, she wasn't allowed to do fighter pilot, but to be a combat pilot. Now, apparently, you can if you're good enough. But she was a fighter pilot. And then she went to Southwest Airlines. Her husband has the same job as she does. In fact, she was filling in for him the day that engine blew up, because he was on another flight. Now, how did she make that? She knew what to do, because she had acquired skills through repeated practice. For instance, the first thing she did was to go down to a lower altitude. Why that? Why that first? Because oxygen starvation, you had all the air leaving from the hole in the fuselage, and the things that come down only last for a few minutes, so everyone would die if you stayed at that altitude, so she immediately went down to a lower altitude. She knew how to control the control so the plane wouldn't tip, went into a little bit of a turn, but then she fixed it. Then she calmly called the air traffic control, said, I have a problem. So what's your problem? Oh, an engine blew up. Oh, my God, is it on fire? No, just blew up. I need to know where to go for landing, so give me an airport. I think she went to Philadelphia. She came in for a perfect landing with one engine, and 130 people's lives were saved, and everyone cheered. She was a hero, justifiably. But she didn't take no for an answer. She developed her skills, and it's just like the Sully example. He had the skills from a lot of experience, knew exactly what to do, and did it, saved all those lives. Now, don't be fooled by the popular myth of 10,000 hours. Have you heard of that? 10,000 hour myth, baloney. Here's the myth. Anyone who spends 10,000 hours can be world class. Wrong. This was developed on a study of violinists. And a friend of mine and I were a little bit skeptical, decided to find out more, and I met the guy that did the study and wrote a book on it. And I said, where's the data? Where's the raw data? And he said, oh, I don't know. I think it's in the computer in Stuttgart or some other city in Germany. He said, here's the lab to call. So we emailed the lab, said, we're looking for the data for the violinist. Said, we don't have it anymore. It's gone. So you're supposed to save data like that, but no. But here's the problem. Later, people who were able to grab some of the data, the time isn't fixed, time isn't exact, and the time isn't sufficient to be world-class. Being world-class violinist will not work for 99.99% of the people who play the violin. Now, here's the principle. Effort will make you better at almost anything than you were, especially if you start low. But everyone will not get to the same place. They will not. So I can speak, I'm a tennis player, I'm an average club player, started playing in my 40s. I was below average then, took lots of lessons and played a lot. Now I'm average. That's as far as I'm gonna get. Now I know I'm old, that's part of it, but I wasn't that good when I was young. The amount of coordination and motor control and reaction time that Federer has, you know, maybe five people in the world are even close to that. So if you're pretty talented, you might get in the top 100. If you're a little bit less talented, but very talented, you might get in the top 1,000, but never get past that, because you just aren't good enough. And that's true of every field. If you want to be a physicist and you can't do algebra, you might have a problem, because science is so heavily mathematical. Now, the spirit that you can be better through effort is good. It's a very American spirit, as I mentioned in my free will book. But the fact is, you're not going to get necessarily to the top. And how do you know? You don't know in advance. You've got to try stuff and then see how far you get. When I went to summer camp, when I was 9, they had required tryouts for the glee club or whatever it was. I was dismissed in the first 5 minutes, justifiably. I had no voice. I was glad to get out of that, very embarrassing. So it doesn't matter how many voice lessons, it's not going to happen. So the spirit is good that you can improve, and you don't know how far you can get until you try stuff, see how it comes out. What's the motive for a myth like the 10,000-hour myth? It's clearly political. A lot of political stuff goes under the guise of science. It wants to make everyone equal. We can't have people being born with different skills. No. Can't have that. Everyone's got to be equal. So it's just a matter of effort, but it's not true. Oh, sorry. Went too fast. All right. What's the basis for persistence aside from purpose and passion and thought? Self-confidence. And I don't necessarily mean general self-esteem. I mean task-related self-confidence. The best psychologist in the field today, and maybe the best ever, is Albert Bandura. And I've enjoyed really communicating, even working with him. And he calls this self-efficacy, efficacy in a limited domain. You experience at the ability to understand and learn something and learn it fast. And many prodigies read math books at age 10 or 12, read through the whole math book and understood it perfectly. So you're able to master something that might be relevant to your future actions. And you may acquire knowledge that surpasses the knowledge of experts, the knowledge that you have, skills and discoveries they didn't have. And it's many times that experts tell innovators what they're doing is impossible. I think you know Lord Kelvin's one of the worst. He was a member of the Royal Society of England. He said the Wright brothers' idea would never work. You can't get heavier-than-air thing off the ground. Totally ridiculous. Worse yet, you've heard of Marie Curie, one of the greatest scientists, French. She was the only woman, maybe the only scientist, to get Nobel Prizes in two fields. I think it was physics and chemistry. So she was worked to the hand to the bone. She was totally dedicated, and he said, what you're doing is never going to work, which is understanding radium. Gates, Jobs, even Musk, whom I'm going to come back to, were prodigies as children. They really knew stuff way above their peers and learned very fast. And they were able to say, justifiably, what this teacher says is baloney. They don't know what they're talking about, and often it was true. Because experts can only be expert about the past. So self-efficacy is acquired through repeated success. And also it motivates you if you fail, if you have efficacy, you're less likely to give up. Because you know you still have the skill, you have to reframe what you were doing. All right, let's see. Time issues. What time perspective should you have? I can't give a general answer here. Usually, great creators start smaller scale with a shorter time perspective. Amazon started with what? Anybody know? Books. Started with books. Pretty modest compared to what they do now. They scaled up in stages. They avoided grandiosity. Grandiosity means, I'm such a genius, this project will take over the world and destroy my competitors. They don't have a chance against me. And usually involves shortcutting and trying to grow too fast. So typically, great creators achieve in pieces. Mistakes are caused by usually two things, narcissism, I'm the center of the universe and no one can beat me. And rationalism, since my idea is good, it's true. Because after all, I thought about it rationally, has to be true and apply to reality, which it doesn't necessarily. It can be wrong. You can move too fast, you can be dishonest. So better to do one thing at a time. Here's some examples of long-range thinking, maybe unfair for the rest of my, in relation to the rest of my talk, but I thought I'd mention time perspective. Darwin worked for 22 years on evolution theory before The Origin of the Species. Now the book is torture to read because there's so much stuff he brings in that he tries to integrate and show its relevance. Page after page of dense, really dense stuff, but became world famous and changed the world. Ayn Rand, the greatest genius in philosophy since Aristotle. Took her 7 years to write The Fountainhead. Took 13 years to write Atlas Shrugged. Took 2 years to write Galt's Speech. Now, so imagine 13 years, she's the greatest genius since Aristotle. She has to work 13 years. Why couldn't she do it in 6 months? Didn't work, couldn't do it. Walmart was built one store at a time, starting with the Five and Dime in Bentonville. Then he added another store. His wife told him at one point, well, you must be satisfied now. He said, no, I'm just getting started. She said, I guess you'll never stop. Well, he only didn't until he died. What about time pressure? In other words, deadlines. Again, it's a mixed bag. It can lead to foolish risks, shortcutting, cheating, sloppy work, low quality work. It can also lead, in some cases, to intense focus, intense cooperation, gaining of resources, leading to big breakthroughs. So a lot depends on commitment to reality and the realisticness of the goals and the quality of the leadership. So again, it's a mixed bag. I don't have any particular conclusions except watch that it doesn't lead to foolish shortcuts. A little about Steve Jobs. So here's the question. How did a very intelligent, but emotionally fragile, obnoxious, often mean, narcissistic, pot-smoking, LSD-tripping, barefoot, unwashed, unkempt, smelly, hippie, lover of Asian mysticism and intuition come to be one of history's greatest entrepreneurs? Most of them don't, of course, but he did. How many people do that? Well, free will is real, and he changed. He was very smart, and he understood computers, and he liked computers. And he developed an intense passion for beautiful, user-friendly, which means simplicity products, that excited the imagination, and most of the time using reason and independent judgment to make the products financially successful. Now, he wanted to make money, but his first love was the products. His success took decades of highly focused thinking and independent judgment. This included finding and utilizing scores of brilliant people, A players, to work for him. And many of the proposed designs for every aspect of his products involve using brilliant people. He favored integrated products, which are reliable, aesthetically pleasing, simple, easy to use. He gave his employees and suppliers what seemed to any sane person to be ridiculous, impossible goals, and drove them to achieve things they never thought were possible, and they did. Now, sometimes this backfires, but with the abuse, he could also inspire. He was demanding, sometimes abusive, and sometimes lied. But he could inspire. He envisioned things no customer ever asked for, or vastly improved devices that existed. So the Apple, the Macintosh, iTunes, iPhone, iPad, despite many setbacks and failures, including being fired and failing twice. Remember, failure is normal for great people. Now consider the iPhone as an example. How many things were involved in something so utterly simple? the on-screen keyboard took 6 months of full-time work, just how it would look on the face of it. What would be the keyboard would be like? What would be the would be numerical alphabetic? Would it be call-upable, or would it be already there? Can you use phones as well as messages? Is there a keypad? Can you do texting? Can you do videos? Can you do photographs? What do you have to touch to get those things to work? This doesn't include time spent on size, thinness, shape, choices of metal, choice of glass, all of the innards in the software. Many, many, many thousands of man hours on the concrete details. Now add to that many, many scores of hours on marketing plans. Microsoft, by the way, said the iPhone would be a total flop. So even geniuses can be wrong. During the iPhone development, which is his last major thing, I guess besides the ones he did simultaneously, he was suffering from what would eventually be a fatal cancer. During this time, he lectured President Obama about the harm of business regulation and about the failure of our educational system. So, and then what did I hear Iran say? This wasn't in Isaacson's book, I don't think. I didn't know he had read Atlas Shrugged. Isaacson's book, unless I missed it, never mentioned it. Maybe deliberately, I'm not sure. But good for him if he appreciated that. From his first efforts to the final products, it was a period of 35 years of work, punctuated by failures. 35 years spent thinking and trying stuff. Okay, implementing. In my book, The Prime Movers, I stress that visions have to be implemented in action. Otherwise, the vision remains a floating abstraction. Implementation requires taking the idea and doing something, usually thousands of things, in concrete reality. This requires specific goals for action and almost always working for colleagues, which I mentioned, they were called in my book the right-hand man, but they can be now right-hand women, who are as expert as you up to a point. So you must be able to spot and hire people. Henry Ford, early on, had brilliant people running the assembly line. Late in the 20s, he fired his best guy, saying, he was too smart for me. Guess where he went? General Motors. GM became the number one car maker. Ford never caught them again. So early, right, late, made a bad mistake. Jobs treasured, especially Jonathan Ive, who was a genius designer, I think he was English, and he was totally in sync with Jobs aesthetically. Jobs had tremendous confidence in him. I think he's still at Apple. Jobs even occasionally took credit for Ive's ideas. Now, when you get to implementing, you need goals for implementation. The book on my list by John Doerr, Measure What Matters, talks the whole book's about goal setting. And this was very important in the development of Google as a company. If I can boast, Doerr told the heads of Google about my ideas for goals, and they ran with them. I don't take credit for that. Doerr's book is really, really good. It's way beyond any work I've done. He's developed it so much. So I think you might find that book interesting in terms of implementation. So finally, a word about Elon Musk. So I want to give my personal opinion here. I don't want to get into what was talked about by Yaron on getting subsidies, although it's true. I want to talk about something else. My personal opinion is Musk is intellectually a genius. He was brilliant at it. He was a prodigy. He was brilliant at an early age. He's very visionary, and he has vision for lots of things, not just cars. But he has a big weakness. He's not good at implementation. He's not good at it. He can't get the cars out. He doesn't seem to have skilled production people in place. He had two recent operations experts hired for this purpose, left the company, doesn't say why. Probably they had a fight with him. He's now making cars in a tent out of desperation. He's now sleeping under his desk, but he hasn't hired people who are experts in car making. And Tesla's losing money by the millions, falling deeper into debt every year, despite the benefits of tax breaks and subsidies. And it's even worse than that, because people signed up for the $30,000, $35,000 car, but he's building more of the $75,000 car because he can't make much money on the $35,000, maybe none. So then he's not satisfying the customers of many, many, many thousands who paid a deposit for the $35,000 car. Nobody knows if he can get the cars built. Every single promise, production promise, has been missed. How's it going to turn out? Nobody knows. One thing's for sure, you cannot survive on hype, and you can't survive on promises and constant goals which you don't achieve. If you want to talk about this philosophically, I would say there's too much Plato and too little Aristotle. Now, why did I pick those two guys? Plato had abstractions divorced from concrete reality, so ideas in the mind. Aristotle said only particulars exist and was understood that everything starts with a sense perception and therefore with particulars. Musk is too much in the Plato level. And another thing I didn't mention, he made a mess of the robots because he started using robots who weren't smart enough to do parts of the work. So then they had to take them down and wrecked up everything. So I don't know how this is going to turn out. I don't give investment advice. I have no prediction. Short selling, which is selling, making money if the price goes down, is treacherous. You can lose your money from shorts. And there's lots of short sellers. And there's lots of long buyers. So there's millions of investors betting on either one. I have no idea how this will turn out, but I have a certain skepticism that he can't deal with the real world very well. And I fear then if he starts to go bankrupt, he'll demand a government bailout. And I'm wondering if he'll get it. He might. I don't know. So, conclusion. The root of creativity is real mindfulness, the use of the conceptual faculty persistently and for long periods of time. The root of creativity is plain, hard, conscious work, with the subconscious working as a storage mechanism, a consolidator and feeder, but not the prime mover. It will only help you if you consciously love what you're doing and you do a great deal of conscious work to the best of your ability in order to achieve actual results in the real world. Then the subconscious, if you go back and forth, stop and start and stop, pulse, will store it and it will feed it back and then you can use it again. Now, I want to give, as a non-tech person, I want to give an idea here, which may or may not interest you, about the future. Now, if you know the internet, as far as I can determine, it has most of the knowledge ever discovered in the history of the world. I once texted how many pages it was, and I forget what it was, hundreds of trillions of pages of stuff. Now, what's wrong here? How does this deal with the Crow principle? It's a nightmare, right? It has all the world's knowledge, but how can you get it in a form that you can use? The problem gets worse daily. But here's the opportunity, untold opportunities to help the mind deal with this amount of information. And big data is only scratching the surface. Google search is only scratching the surface. Wikipedia is only scratching the surface. So to my mind, if you want to be in the high tech, you can find a way to help the human mind process in line with the Crow principle. You have 1,000 years of opportunity ahead of you. So, stop there. Thank you. So, how much time do we have for questions? Nobody? Somebody back there knows my time. I don't know. Oh, let's. 20 minutes? Okay. Questions? Yes.
Hi, Ed. How you doing?
Hi.
So I wanted to see if you would agree to an addition to your list of conscious activities, actions in creativity. This is another one that to me is important. And I think the people that talk about thinking outside the box or outside the square are kind of onto something. They don't say it right, but the problem is that what we call the subconscious, or you call the subconscious, is itself a box. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of programs, mm-hmm. and if you are limited to what comes out of your subconscious, you are limited to whatever's in the box.
Yes.
What consciousness enables you to do is to override that programming, to go beyond what comes to your mind automatically, and that's a really key function of consciousness in any kind of creative thinking.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say override, I'd say add.
I would say override. I'll give you a really simple example if you've got 30 seconds.
20 seconds.
20 seconds, okay. You got a wheel of cheese. You want to cut it into the minimum, you want to cut it into 8 pieces with minimum number of cuts. A lot of people are going to sit there, play around well, and they'll come out with 1, 2, 4. And they won't go any further because they're assuming a two-dimensional approach. And that would be right. But if they can overcome that program that limits them to two-dimensional approach, they'll see they can go 1, 2, and 3 right through the middle and do it with 3. Or they might see they can go 1, 2, take the pieces and stack them, and then go like that. But in order to do that, they have to overcome the programming that restricts them to a two-dimensional approach. The assumptions, bad assumptions, basically.
Well, I don't like examples like that. You know why? Because it's like the thinking outside the square, connecting the dots. It's too simple. It's not a product.
I could give you better ones, but we don't have time.
Okay. You can have assumptions in your subconscious which are not correct, but the purpose of the conscious mind is really to program it. And you might have a conflict between the conscious and subconscious. You might overlook something. But if the conscious mind is active, then I don't worry about the subconscious. As long as it's active, it'll catch stuff like that. As long as you have challenging thinking processes and people to work with. So, okay.
Hi, Mr. Locke. I wanted to ask about the subconscious quad dreams. I understand it's a very Freudian question. And when it came to his psychology, it was something to contend with, but with his philosophy being all determinism, it's not really worth the real anything, I guess. But I wanted to ask about dreams because I know when in your talk you said sometimes people have dreams and then it's a really in-depth dream and then they write about it, say a book. But then you said, of course, it's not really something too reliable on. I wanted to ask why you said that, because if the subconscious is active in your sleep.
Yeah. Your subconscious is active, but your conscious mind is not. Mm-hmm. So all kinds of things. Now, Freud had a theory that all dreams are about sex and aggression. It was totally ridiculous. And so he had to make up rationalizations for your dream and fake dream interpretations. No matter what you dreamed about, it was a phallic symbol or a vaginal symbol. It was ridiculous. So that got given up. Nobody believes that anymore. But I used to have anxiety dreams in college that I missed the final exam. That wasn't wish fulfillment. That was fear that I wasn't keeping close track of the time of day. So I don't know if there's any theory. I think you tend to dream about things you have some concern with in your regular life, but it's not consciously regulated. So I don't believe I don't remember most of my dreams, so I don't put too much store in it. If something comes out when you wake up that you can use, go for it. But I don't have a theory of dreams.
Thank you.
Okay. Shoshana?
This isn't a question, but it's a follow-up. When, and I think you know this, but maybe some of the other people don't, you mentioned the development of the atomic bomb as, you know, an adventure in creativity. And Ayn Rand wrote a screenplay about that, you know, back in 1946.
Yes.
And so she absolutely, you know, herself was very interested in that, and she read the science, and she explored the history. And if only, I wish that film had been made.
Yes, me too. And she had a German, a famous German scientist.
She interviewed Oppenheimer.
Mittner. Was it Mittner?
She interviewed Oppenheimer, and she met some of the other scientists as well. And she was going to have bad scientists and good scientists, and the Germans and the
there was
French
that woman scientist, I think, was in her plot, and she was leaving the country.
Yes, that's right.
The German Gestapo said, "What are you taking with you?" She said nothing, and it was all in her mind.
Right. Well, you can imagine the camera was going to go in on her face, what she's taking
and
out of the country.
She was an important person in the development of the theory of the atomic bomb, right?
Yes, it was it was Lise Meitner.
Lise Meitner.
Right. And as a matter of fact, later on, another movie, not Ayn Rand's movie, was made about that, and it was not a very good movie, and Lise Meitner was one of the people who refused to be part of it. Because she could see that they weren't making a good movie.
Oh. Yeah.
I mean, they cast Agnes Moorehead, but then they...
And didn't she see Oppenheimer as a kind of Robert Stadler?
Yes. Well, she used some aspects of him for that, but she enjoyed speaking with him, and he enjoyed speaking with her so much that he invited her to come back another time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's a great. It was a great example, and everyone should know that that Ayn Rand
would have been
that too.
A tremendous movie, I think. Yeah. But it's very interesting that the Heisenberg was one of the people involved. But the Germans couldn't get their act together, partly because of Hitler, couldn't get the money and who's going to be in charge and which labs are going to be done in. And after they lost the war, the German scientists were put in a room. They weren't going to be shot, probably should have been, but they were put in a room. And they had recordings of their conversations. And they were quite pissed off. They said, "How did they do that anyway?" They were not pleased. But I have a theory, and I don't have enough history knowledge. I wonder if the keys to that failure were the defections by Jewish scientists.
Mm.
I think it would have been a very interesting movie if it's true, because the best scientists left and say, "By the way, Nazis, the defeat of your country is due to the Jewish scientist you wanted to kill." I don't know if it's true, but I thought it would be tremendous. Movie, if it were.
Well,
I
think it's a very interesting story, and she saw it as being about the power of the creative mind and what it needs in order to work properly. You know, freedom, which is one of the things you mentioned. So I'm glad, you mentioned it. I thought of Ayn Rand, I thought it would be okay to say.
It was especially shocking that Heisenberg, who helped, was one of the people that there was conflicts, was treated as a normal human being after the war. Yet he was a leading advocate of the atomic bomb for the Nazis. Nobody seemed to hold that against him. He was famous for the uncertainty principle, but I don't know if that came later. But thank you for that. Yeah, I remember that story, and wouldn't it be great if they made a movie like that?
Well, it worked out okay, because as soon as she stopped working on that movie, when her studio made a deal with the other studio, she got back to work on Atlas Shrugged. And
that's okay.
That worked out.
That was okay.
Yeah.
That was okay. Okay.
Ed, when you're deciding to invent something, you also want to project the future, whether it's a good idea, whether it's going to grow. Do you have anything to say on what strengths these people have to project, whether the iPhone's going to be a...
This is a very, very interesting question. How do you be visionary? No, a lot of problems occur when people get stuck in the present. Said, you know, this has always worked, so we're not going to talk about other possibilities. So they stagnate, and they've been successful maybe 25 years. GE's kind of stagnated. IBM kind of stagnated. What kind of person can envision successfully when something's been working very well for a long time and you're thinking this, we should go in a different direction because you're really envisioning your own destruction and then creating something better? And I don't know what makes people able to do that. Certainly it's the agreement, it's the decision to look into the future. How do people make those visions? I don't know. So it's a really interesting subject. It'd be interesting to do a study of people who were successful for a long time and then crashed, you know, like Kodak, versus people like Watson Jr. Father made a fortune on mechanical machines, cord sorters. I used those as a grad student, you know, punch cards. And the son, when punch cards machines were selling well, he took the company into the electronic age. Totally different than what IBM had been doing. Now, this was very visionary. It was a tremendous achievement and saved the company from undoubted destruction. And then the person who followed him, after he retired, almost crashed the company again. And then it had to be reinvented again. So it can be very hard to figure out what's going to work in the future that we should be doing, even though we're going to have to hurt. You know, like Kodak couldn't bear to not make money from their film because it was a cash cow. But film was disappearing. I don't even know if the company still exists, even?
Yeah.
Okay. Because the Japanese killed them in making the digital cameras. So it's a very, very interesting question. But I don't have an answer. Okay. Thank you all.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.